You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, February 7th, 2011. I just realized today that all of my podcasts so far this year have said 2010 again, so I have to go back and change those. Anyway, so it's February 7th, 2011, and today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews from the archives, the first with literary agent Douglas Stewart, and then the second interview is with Vermont illustrator Amy Huntington. The show used to just be half an hour long when we first started, and so that's why we can fit two on one today. Douglas Stewart joined the literary agency Sterling Lord Literistic in 2003. Before that, he was an agent at Curtis Brown for more than 7 years. His primary interests are literary fiction, narrative nonfiction, and young adult fiction. Doug's list of award-winning and best-selling authors includes Carolyn Parkhurst, David Mitchell, Jane O'Connor, Gabrielle Zevin, Colin McAdam, Matthew Quick, Dana Reinhart, Graham Joyce, and Michael Dolly, among others. Douglas Stewart and I spoke by phone in 2008, and we began by discussing his decision to become a literary agent.
I kind of fell into it by accident, to be perfectly honest. I went to college at Vassar College, which is in Poughkeepsie, New York, and was an English major there and was always interested in books and writing and thought I might want to write myself. And I moved to New York after I graduated from college back in 1993. And I actually worked in theater for a few years, and after doing that for a while, sort of realized it wasn't for me and wanted to try something different. And I had a friend who had worked at a literary agency called Curtis Brown Limited, and she didn't work there anymore, but she had liked it, and I was looking for a new job, and I ended up going in there for an interview, and I had no idea what literary agents did. I had no idea why they existed or why they were necessary. And I interviewed, and I remember the person I interviewed with said, "Well, you know, do you want to be a literary agent?" And I just said, "I have no idea. I just still don't really understand what you do. But if you hire me, I'll be a really good assistant, and you can ask me again in 6 months."
Well, that's great.
And so they did hire me, and it turned out that I just totally loved it. And now I don't know what else I would do. It turned out to be a good fit, but it certainly was not due to any grand plan on my part that I ended up here.
Now, it seems like a lot of agents start out as being interested in writing and are drawn to that because it's the business of writing. But that must help later when you're in the position of making decisions about manuscripts and editing and things.
Well, I mean, I definitely thought I wanted to be a writer. I mean, I think a lot of people, when they're in college, have artistic aspirations or artistic dreams, and some people are more talented than others and can realize them. And I think I personally do not have the discipline to be a writer, I don't think. Maybe someday I'll change my mind and really buckle down and try and write a book, but I just don't think that right now I don't think that's something that's going to happen for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to be involved with the talented people who are able to write them and write them well. And I think, you know, what is one of the really only qualifications to be an agent or to be a good agent, I think, is, you know, first of all, you just have to love books. Books have to be something that you love spending time with. If you love going into a bookstore and you love reading and you love talking about books, then this could be a good job for you. You also have to really have convictions about what you like and what makes a good book. And it doesn't have to be very scientific. I mean, I just think you have to know what you like, because that's what you're going to be going on all the time, is your gut instinct. And if you really love something, trying to find somebody else who loves it too. And people are going to tell you no as a writer and as an agent over and over and over again.
Right.
Because it's just a very subjective thing. So you have to really you have to be able to really believe in yourself, both as a writer and as an agent, I think.
Right. Speaking to sort of how subjective the process can be and how it's really a gut reaction, what advice you might maybe have for writers doing research, trying to find a really good fit with an agent, the perfect person to work with?
It's hard because agents are kind of behind the scenes, so, you know, it's not always the easiest to find us. At the same time, there's a really easy way to do it, I think, to find people who will be a good matches, to be a good match for you as a writer, and that is to go to your local bookstore or to even to your own bookshelf in your house. And, you know, if I am an aspiring novelist and I'm done with my manuscript and think that it is as good as I can get it and it's ready to go and it's time to start looking for an agent and I just don't know who to turn to, find all of my books on my bookshelf that are recent or books in bookstores that I know about and read about that are successful or maybe share something in common with mine, and go to the acknowledgments page.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the acknowledgments pages, most writers will thank their agents. And some of them will say, some of them will do it in a sneaky way. Like some will just go through and just say, oh, I thank, you know, Doug Stewart and my mom and blah, 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 blah. And not say, but most of them will say, my agent, Doug Stewart, at Sterling Moore Literacy. So there will be clues for you to find people there. And I think that that is the best way. It's the most reliable way, because if you find an agent there that has represented a book that you love, that's just something that you already have in common. You love that book. And then, as a writer, if you write to me and you say, I know that you represented whatever book, and I'm a huge fan of that book, and I just absolutely love it, I would be honored if you would read my work, then I know that you've chosen me on purpose. It's not like you just like went through some listing and sent a letter to 100 people. It actually looks like you've done some research that way, which you have. So I think that is the best way.
Now, that's one great thing to mention in a query letter, you know, that I loved this book that I know you represented. What are some other things that people can try to include in a really good query letter?
You know, it's funny, because writing a good query letter, you would think it would be really easy, especially for a writer. But you would be surprised at how bad most of the query letters are that we get. And so I think if somebody can write a really good letter, it kind of stands apart. So I would really advise anybody listening to this who's about to start querying agents to really take the time to write a good letter. And by writing a good letter, I'll tell you what I mean. It's pretty simple. The first and most important thing, I think, is to lead off the letter by introducing yourself and letting the agent know, in addition to why, you know, what work you're querying about, also let us know why you came to us. And I think that we like to see that, you know, appeal to our vanity a little bit, that you chose us to come to for a reason, that you know something about us, you've done some research, like I said, that you've, you know, you know a book I represent,
mm-hmm.
or anything like that. Use your introduction well and make it targeted. Don't write a dear sir, dear madam letter.
Right.
Don't write the exact same letter to 25 agents. We can tell. The other thing is, in the letter, it's just very simple. In addition to that introduction, after that, you write a paragraph telling us a little bit about your book, what it's about. The last paragraph should tell us a little bit about you as a writer. It should tell us, where have you been published before? If you've had short stories published in any journals, if you are a nonfiction writer, if you've had magazine articles published, if you've written for your local paper. And if you haven't had any of that stuff, it's okay. Don't try and make it up. Sometimes people say weird things like, you know, my work has appeared in many magazines and newspapers. Well, what magazines and newspapers? If it's really true, then tell us what they are. We don't care if it's tiny local newspaper. If you're writing for your local newspaper, somebody there thinks you can write. You know, they don't let anybody write for the local newspaper. So anything that sort of establishes you as somebody who's taking writing seriously and has been doing this for a long time, or, you know, just be honest and let us know anything we might be interested to know. So I think those are the basics of a simple query letter. There are a lot of mistakes, a lot of traps that people fall into because they think that their letter needs to be flashy.
So
we get a lot of letters where people say, you know, well, I'm the next John Grisham, or, you know, I've written the next Da Vinci Code. And it's kind of, you just kind of think, well, I doubt it. I don't think, we don't like to hear claims of grandeur.
Right.
You just want to make the work sound interesting. And, you know, if the work sounds interesting, we'll look at it, and then the work really needs to stand on its own.
Now, how many of the people who are sending you query letters have met you before?
Very few. I think most of the letters, I mean, I can tell you really how many unsolicited queries I personally get a day. I mean, we get several a day. You know, it's not like we get like a huge mail sack that we empty out on the floor every day, but we get anywhere maybe between 5 and 10 a day, and usually none of those people knows me. And, you know, they go into a pile, and that's the way that it goes. I mean, we do look at them all, and we look at them very carefully, because there are often really good things that come out of the slush pile. It is true that if somebody has a connection to me, it will go to the top of the pile.
Right.
If it's a friend of a current client, if it's somebody who I met at a writer's conference, if it's somebody who, I don't know, who even just, you know, knows my mother. So it could be anything. If there's any sort of connection, that letter will usually go to the top of the pile. And so if there's any connection as a writer that you have to an agent or any resources available to you, you know, if you attend a workshop and a writer there has connections for you to take advantage of, go ahead and take advantage of them, because I think we take those kinds of things very seriously. That said, if you don't have any, we take them seriously too. Sometimes it just takes a little longer, that's all.
Right, right. Now, do people tend to send sample pages along with their query letters when they submit to you?
No, different agents like things to come in different ways. Especially with, you know, email being what it is and sort of the preferred mode of communication for so many people, I think that sort of makes things a little bit tricky too. You know, for me, I still mostly prefer getting query letters by snail mail.
Mm-hmm.
I just prefer it that way because I think we all do so much business over email that I don't want my email inbox getting cluttered up with just random query letters coming in over it constantly. That said, if somebody comes in, if a really good one comes in, I'm going to respond to it over email, but I still would prefer it by snail mail.
Mm-hmm.
I also prefer, if somebody's written a novel, in particular a novel or a memoir, something where the writing is going to have to really speak to me, I prefer that people send some sample pages with it. Never send the full manuscript. Our offices are only so big, if everybody sent full manuscripts in, we just wouldn't know what to do with them. So I like it when people just send a sample. Send you know, anywhere from 10 pages to 50 pages, but I don't think you ever need to send more than that unless somebody specifically asked you to.
When you look at those sample pages, what might stand out and make you want to see more?
Well, I always talk about it as an example. I think it's a good story for writers who maybe don't have any connections to anybody and have written a novel that they think is good and are ready to go. I think this is always a good story to share and hope it gives people some hope that they can find the right person. I represent a writer named Carolyn Parkhurst, who finished her first novel, I'm not going to remember the exact year, but let's say 2000, maybe 2001, something like that, and it was called The Dogs of Babel, which went on to be a big bestseller for Little Brown and sold all over the world, and there's going to be a movie made, and it was a huge success, one of those sort of rare things that can occasionally happen for a first book. And she didn't know anyone and didn't know what to do. She had found somebody who was an acquaintance of hers that she went to college with, who was an editorial assistant, who just gave her some names of some agents, and I happened to be one of them. And so she sent off query letters, not knowing anything. And she wrote a really good letter. And in her letter to me, it just, the premise for this novel sounded so bizarre. The story, in a nutshell, is, you know, she said this is the story of a man whose wife dies by falling out of a tree in his backyard. And the only witness to the death is their dog. And the police come and they rule that it was an accident, that she just fell out of the tree, but the husband fears it may have been a suicide. And he tries to teach his dog how to speak to tell him what really happened. And I remember reading that and thinking, well, that sounds completely bizarre. And it sounds like it might be terrible. But it could be really good if she's a good enough writer. And she had included just her first 10 or 15 pages. And the story itself intrigued, you know, her description of the story was unique enough that I wanted to read those sample pages that she had attached. So I read them, and they were really alluring. It was clear that she was a really good writer. The beginning of the novel just really made me want to read more. And so I immediately asked for the whole thing, and I ended up taking her on. And you know, we still work together today, and her first two books have been Times bestsellers. And I think to answer your question, what allured me about her letter were two things. One was just that the description of the book is unique. The story, if you're writing a novel or you're writing a memoir about your own personal history or some aspect of your life, it should be different and new. If you write in your letter, you know, it's a family drama set in Vermont on a farm, I've enclosed 15 pages, that's not interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, come up with something that you think is different and new, because otherwise people aren't going to pay attention. But then, once you've done that, the pages have to be good enough. And so the work is the most important thing. The work has to really stand on its own. You just have to get people to read it first.
Right.
But then the work has to be good enough in the end. So that's really the two most important things, if that was clear.
You mentioned memoir, and I wanted to know, is there a difference when someone approaches you with a novel or a memoir or a nonfiction project?
Yes. I think, you know, I do a lot of fiction and memoir myself, so that's I tend to think in those terms. But I think fiction and memoir being nonfiction most of the time, despite recent issues in the news, but memoir and fiction, I think, are very similar. You know, the best memoirs read like fiction, and if you know what I mean, they're very narrative,
right.
Very voice-driven. So I think those two things, in terms of approaching agents, are usually kind of the same. They're very similar. In terms of approaching, if you've written a nonfiction book, whether it be a biography or serious history or even, you know, something funnier, anything that you've done in the nonfiction arena, it's a little bit different. Because most of the time, as a beginning writer, if I'm selling a novel for you or a memoir, I'm probably going to be selling it on a complete manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be something that, regardless of what stage we started working together as writer and agent, I'm not going to send it out to editors at publishing houses until you're done writing it. Whereas with a nonfiction, a more traditional nonfiction project, in terms of current events or biography or whatever, most of the time those nonfiction projects are sold on a proposal. And so the most important thing in terms of a nonfiction query letter is really establishing yourself as an expert in the field that you're writing about. So, you know, that is where having real credentials is really important, because a publisher is always going to want you to be, you know, the question is, why do you have to write this book? Why are you the person to write about this subject? You want to be the premier expert in your field, and a publisher is always looking for a writer to have what's called a platform. What credentials do you have that are going to sell this book? So if you are writing a book about the government, about how, you know, about the Democratic campaign this year and the differences between Obama and Hillary, why do people care what you have to say about it? Are you a columnist for the Washington Post? Are you somebody who is, you know, a political analyst for NPR? You need to have those kinds of things. You can't just sort of randomly decide to write a nonfiction book. You have to sort of be an expert in your field.
Although, you know, now that the genre of the blog is so big, and do you find people being sort of mini experts because they have a sort of personal following in that way?
Yes, and that's a really, really great thing for aspiring writers, because if you can build yourself an audience, that counts as a platform. That's what a publisher wants to see, is they want to see that people like you and that they are not, you know, risking money on an unknown quantity. So if you are somebody who thinks you have something to say about anything, and you start a blog about it, and you can start keeping track of your page visits, and if you can, the best thing is if you can get people to sign up for some kind of newsletter from you, and you can get contact information people and get a subscriber base, even if people aren't paying for that subscribership, that's really worth a lot. Because if you can come to an agent, and then an agent can go to a publishing house and say, listen, this person has a website where they send out a newsletter once every month, and they have 5,000 people who have signed up, that's huge, because the publisher will think, God, well, this person did this on his own. Think what we can do with the resources of a publishing and a market, a publicity and a marketing department. The internet is a great thing for any writer to sort of build a fan base, and I think there are many, 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 many writers who have turned blogs into book deals.
Okay. I have a kind of a funny question for you, but I think authors tend to be falling into one or two categories, sometimes both, of being maybe quite vain and self-confident, and also extremely self-critical. And I'm curious if you think that those are, will one or the other of those hurt an author's chances for success, or is that just kind of typical?
Well, I mean, you know, I think you have to be a little bit of both, because I think writing is just such a solitary experience that you have to be a little bit vain, because you have to think you're talented enough that it's worth your time to do this, and you have to be self-critical, otherwise it's just not going to work. So, I mean, at least for most writers, unless you're just so brilliant that everything you put on the page is perfect the first time around, which is rare. I don't think that probably really ever happens. But I think in terms of pros and cons of both, what you don't want to be in terms of self-critical is get to the point where you can't ever let go of something. There are some writers who just will work something to death, will just write it and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it and pick it apart and pick it apart and never let go of it. And part of that, I think, is fear of letting something go out into the world. And I think there's always a time to let something go. Especially, I mean, it's not an exact science, writing, so it's never going to be perfect. And any manuscript can always be better. And I think if you're really self-critical, you just have to finally reach a point where it's time to let it go.
Right.
That said, you don't want to let it go too early. You always want your work to be as good as you think it can get. But there's a time where I think when you start reworking something too many times where it can actually start to get worse. So that can be a danger. On the other side of the coin, writers who just think that they're perfect, and, you know, a writer who might write to me and say, I've written the next Da Vinci Code and actually believe it, you know, or maybe even worse, saying that they've written, like, the next corrections or something and believe it. That's hard, because people in this business have a lot of opinions, and you're going to hear them. And I think in terms of having some vanity, yes, you want to believe your work. You want to believe in your work, but you also want to be able to hear things that can help you. And like I said, I really do think every manuscript can always be better. It's not an exact science. And so sometimes people are going to tell you things that might be hard to hear. I think as a writer, you should listen. And a key, you know, as an agent, we have to do that too. I mean, I think we can, you know, when we send, if I send a novel out into the marketplace and send it to 8 editors, and it's something that I really, really, truly believe in, and it gets rejected by all 8 editors, I really need to listen to what they have to say, because I might clearly everybody's not jumping on it. So while I may not be wrong that this may actually have value in the marketplace, as it stands, there's clearly a problem. and I need to listen to try and figure out what that is. And so I think, and then of course relay that to my client. So I think you have to listen to the marketplace a little bit too, and if people are telling you that something is wrong, you have to make a real decision about whether you're going to try and jump that hurdle and really believe that you're right and they're wrong, or whether you're shooting yourself in the foot and maybe you should step back and try and you know, in quotes, fix some things.
Right,
so
right.
It's a fine balance.
I just have one last question for you. I was just wondering, you know, generally speaking, for writers that might be listening, do you have any advice for the publishing process as a whole?
You know, my biggest advice to writers out there is not to worry too much about all the stuff that we've been talking about while you're writing. I think the worst projects that we see are people who are written by writers who have tried to write bestsellers or who have tried to please agents or editors. The best projects out there are by writers who have gone into, you know, their solitary writing world and written projects that they are passionate about, that they really, really want to write, and then sent them out when they're ready. So I think my biggest advice is to not go out there and you know, don't write to me and tell me about your project until it's ready. And when it's ready, I want to see it. But I want it to be something that you really are passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not, we're not going to be either. But if you are, it's really going to shine through, and then you've made your job so much easier. So, you know, I would say forget about me and all those other agents out there until you're really ready.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very, very much for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Write the Book on WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with literary agent Douglas Stewart. More information about Doug and his work at Sterling Lord can be found online at SLL.com. That's S as in Sterling, L as in Lord, and another L for literistic.com. My second interview that I'm airing today from our archives is with Vermont illustrator Amy Huntington. She's also an author. Amy's the author and illustrator of One Monday, and she's the illustrator of Grandma Drove the Garbage Truck by Katie Clark, Seagull Sam, which is also by Katie Clark, The Three Lessons of Astaire the Bear by Martin Brennan, No English by Jacqueline Jules, and Matthew and Tall Rabbit Go Camping by Susan Meyer. Amy Huntington has illustrated two new books since our interview, Moose Power by Susan Williams Beckhorn, which came out in 2010, and also Grandma made another foray into the literary world last fall when a new book appeared on the scene, Grandma Drove the Snowplow. Amy Huntington lives and works in an old farmhouse in Williston. In addition to her illustrations, she spends time gardening, making house repairs, taking care of cats, family, chickens, and the occasional fish. And she creates worlds of her own with color and world and words. She can usually be found in her studio, which faces east over pastures and Camel's Hump. In the summer, curious cows peer in her windows from across the road. Wild turkeys, raptors, deer, foxes, and coyotes forage in the fields. And now you are about to hear an interview with Amy Huntington. I hope you enjoy it.
I actually went to college for art, got a degree in art, and I got out of college and worked various jobs while showing in galleries when I could, or I just started off showing wherever I could show. And when I had young kids, that's when I became interested in.
Now, where did you go to college?
I went to three different colleges. I started off at Swain School of Design, which is a tiny college of 200 students down in New Bedford, Mass. Mm-hmm. And from there, I got married and went to University of Florida. My husband was from Florida. And that was a huge school. And then I ended up at the University of Vermont for my last year.
Okay. So where are you from?
I'm from Massachusetts.
Okay. And when you started showing in galleries, where were you living?
I was living in Vermont.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you work in watercolor and gouache, colored pencil and woodcut.
Mm-hmm.
Did I miss anything?
Oil paints.
And oil paints,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Sometimes acrylic.
So when you are starting to work with a given project, how do you choose which medium you'll work in?
Well, I typically, for illustration, I mostly work in watercolor. It's quick. It's one I'm very comfortable with at this point. The woodcuts I love to do just for a change. I tend to do those for myself, although I've done them for design projects before, t-shirt designs and some posters. Yeah, I typically work in watercolor, and the watercolor I combine with colored pencil and gouache often.
I saw when we were in your studio earlier that you start with pencil,
mm-hmm.
or is that just to lay things out for yourself, and then when you start working in watercolor, do you do a little pencil sketch first? Or?
I often do. If I'm doing a job, I do. If I'm doing just a piece for myself, I often work right onto the watercolor paper
okay.
with pencil first. But when I'm working on a job, I typically do a sketch on a piece of paper, and then I trace it on a tracing table onto the watercolor paper once I have something that I'm happy with.
Now, you do greeting cards.
I've tried to do greeting cards.
Oh, okay. I saw some greeting cards somewhere on the
yeah.
web that you've
yeah.
done. And I saw that you had done some alphabet cards for a school.
I have a friend who just started her first year of teaching, and I've known her since she was three, and she's always wanted to be a teacher, so I've been doing those cards for her. I'm not done yet, but it's a long process. There's a lot of letters in the alphabet.
That's great. Your illustrations strike me as very, very colorful, but also very soft at the same time. And I'm curious if you consciously plan the composition and use of color in your paintings and your illustrations, or do you do these aspects come together sort of as you work?
I think it's probably a combination. Certainly there are some color choices that you make consciously, but I think the more you work, the more that becomes intuitive.
Of the books that you've worked on, do you have a favorite one or two?
Probably the one that I wrote I enjoyed the most. And also because that was the first book that I published, so that was a very exciting time to actually... It took me about 8 or 9 years to get my first book published, so...
And that was one Monday?
That was one Monday, yes.
Now, is that going to be coming out in print again? Or I noticed that that's out of print right now.
It's out of print. I've gotten the rights back to it, and I would like to get it published again.
Do you have any plans to write another of your illustrated books?
Yes, I have written and illustrated many, always working, trying to get one. I think that when One Monday first came out, or when I first submitted it, was a time when the picture book market was very good, and it's a little less good right now. Mm-hmm. So it's a little harder to get a picture book published.
Are there a lot more people working in this industry? Is that why? Is the competition stiffer? Or
I think it's the economy more than
economy.
Anything, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it sort of comes in waves.
Yeah.
So,
The faces of the characters within these books that you've illustrated are very realistic. I'm curious how you do that. How do you manipulate watercolor, which, you know, is I would think it's kind of hard to make that a detailed face.
Well, I think part of it is that I have to have a face that I'm working with, a specific face. So I do collect a lot of pictures of faces. I take pictures, I collect out of the newspaper and magazines. As far as getting the detail, I use a lot of really tiny brushes.
Is that where the colored pencils come in, too? I mean, do they help you?
I don't use the colored pencils on the faces so much, but I really... That's my favorite part of the picture, is the expression on the faces, so I spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah, I think that must be really hard, but they look great. They're so expressive, each face.
Well, and I've talked to other illustrators before who do the whole picture and do the face last, and I... Because they want the rest of the picture to look just right, and for me, I do the faces first because the faces have to be right. And if they aren't right, then I would start over again.
I would think that it would be very frustrating if the face didn't come together and you'd already done the whole painting.
Yeah, that's the way I feel.
And so in, along the same lines as that last question, the personalities of the characters you illustrate do really come through. When you first paint a character, what other than the text might you draw on for inspiration? Now you just said you take pictures.
I do. I think it's, for me, developing a character is a lot about just doing it. And I think it's probably the same with writing, just sort of putting your butt in the chair and doing it. And I have to actually be sitting with the paper in front of me, and I have to start doing scribbles, and I have to start getting the character's face down. You know, if I get really, if I really get stuck, I mean, I do need to take a break, or I need to get out some other illustrators who I admire and look at their work and get some inspiration. But yeah, the expressions on the characters' faces and just getting everything right is really a matter of just doing it, I think.
In some of the characters, I would think it becomes a little more clear early on what their features will be. In No English, the main character, or one of the main characters, is Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of already know what the coloring direction would be. But then I'm always curious, too, you know, when you have a character that isn't described, how do you decide, is this person going to be a redhead? Is this person going to be...
Well, I think you really try to mix it up.
Yeah.
And I do try to just have a variety. And that's why I think I have to collect pictures of faces, because it's really hard just to have those varieties in your head. It's nice to have pictures to look at to give you the individual faces so that they aren't looking generic.
And when you do look to other illustrators for inspiration, or just people that you whose work you admire, who might you be?
I have a very wide range, and I collect a lot of picture books. One of my favorites probably is Janet Stevens. When I was growing up, there weren't a lot of picture books. You know, I think just it was at Where the Wild Things Are came out in 1963. I was just looking that up before you came, and I was born in 56, so I was almost over the age of, you know, that book appealing to me. And so some of my favorite books were had some of the illustrators like N.C. Wyeth. I love N.C. Wyeth. Mm-hmm. Arthur Rackham. There are just a whole bunch of the, you know, Peter and the Peter Rabbit, some mm-hmm. of the illustrations from Peter Rabbit. So I think those, as a kid, were some of my favorite illustrators. I've always loved Steve Johnson, who's more current. And
do you find that you can draw inspiration from illustrators who have a very different style?
Oh, definitely, definitely. In fact, I find that that's a plus sometimes, just sort of stretching your where you're going with your illustration, looking at other people's work.
How long are you likely to sit and work on something without needing to get up and move
on
and get away from it?
Procrastination. I probably work for about an hour and then I take a break.
Yeah.
Whether it's to go look at the computer in the summer, I'll just go walk around the yard and look at the gardens for 5 minutes, and I really have to do that physically and mentally, just to take just a stretch and have a break.
Now, you live on a farm,
mm-hmm.
and you have a lot of animals.
Mm-hmm. And you hear the one ringing the bell at the door.
Is that her way of
that's
saying
the cat,
she
yes.
wants to come in? That's great. I don't know if the recorder picked that up, but the cat is ringing the bell to come in. And you have a lot of hens.
Yes.
And what else do you have?
That's it.
Okay.
Fish. Yeah.
So do you draw all of these animals that are around you all the time?
Definitely. In fact, the hens were really the inspiration for One Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had not been living in this house too long when I wrote that story. And just thinking about this farmhouse, it's very windy here, and the story is about a windy week on Annabelle's farm. So, yeah, the stories are chickens are definitely an inspiration, and the cats.
I'm trying to remember, are your books located in a certain place, or is it just left nameless?
It doesn't say Vermont, no.
Okay.
No. Although Annabelle, who's the main character, was the last woman in a family who bought this farmhouse in 1916.
Oh.
So she was the last one of that family who lived here.
Oh, okay. Next to your barn are many, many, many yellow flags.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of flags that are used for invisible fencing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw them, I assumed that those had to do with the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
My husband was, well, we both were frustrated that the war had been going on for a while. This was back last November, 2 Novembers ago. And we felt like it was sort of getting lost in the media, that the media wasn't really focusing on the fact that so many people were dying in Iraq. And so he really wanted to do something to sort of just bring that to people's attention and make people think. And so it's been a wonderful project because we go out there and pull up all those flags and replant them every time we mow the lawn.
Oh my gosh.
And we found that, first of all, there was a state rep who lives up the street who organized through the local paper some people to come and help us replant the flags every week. But also we found that if we were out there doing that, that people would stop and just offer to help and say that, you know, they'd been driving by and were, wanted to know about it and wanted to, you know, liked it, liked the idea and wanted to help. So,
and you have one flag for each soldier who's
yes.
died in
mm-hmm.
Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And do you keep them up to date every week?
In the winter, not so much because the ground is frozen.
Right.
But, yeah.
So you'll
see every few weeks.
To them soon.
Yes. I think it's gone over the 4,000 mark mm-hmm. now, so. He originally ordered 4,000 of them, never thinking that he'd use them all.
Right,
so.
Right. When you drive toward your house, when one drives toward your house, they're very eye-catching and they flutter in the breeze mm-hmm. in the bright yellow. And at mm-hmm. first, actually, they're really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get closer and you start to wonder, what is that? And, you know, it hit me what it was. And it's really quite intense to think about what that represents. You know,
yeah.
really. Puts the number out there in some other form than just a single digit of black and white.
Right, right.
Now, another art form that you pursue, you spin your own wool.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you get your wool? From another farm, obviously. You don't have sheep.
All different places. I go to the wool festival in the fall, which is in Essex, and I get online and look around, see who's local, see who I can mm-hmm. find wool from.
Is that, that's a very different craft? Is that sort of more mindless and
yes, it's
pleasant.
Yeah, it is. It's very zen. It's very calming.
And then you have felted people that you create.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about those?
Those have sort of influenced what some of my faces look like, I think. I just came upon that one day. I came upon some wool sculpture at a yarn store, and I sit with my sharp little needles and raw wool and just sort of started sculpting these faces. They're sort of busts of face with the shoulders and sometimes some arms, and it's also very calming.
You have a collection of these wonderful felted people, you know, faces and busts. Do you sell those, or are they just for you?
I don't sell them. I haven't. I've considered it, but I found that the ones I wanted to sell were the ones that I really didn't like that well, and the other ones I really didn't want to get anyone else to have.
Yeah, it's not like you can keep a print of them the way you can.
Right.
Going back to illustration, do you have favorite illustration techniques? And I think I mean outside of the media that we've already discussed, as far as, I know you can do some masking in watercolor. Do you ever do that?
I really don't. I haven't ever gotten comfortable with that, so I tend to use very antiquated, just sort of put the watercolor on the paper.
Do you ever project an image onto paper?
No, I've never done that.
It's just you're looking at something and
yeah,
painting.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you might integrate the computer into what you do on paper?
I use the computer to sort of fine-tune some of the pictures that I've worked on. If I want to post a picture on my website, I'll use the lasso tool to draw around a figure, for instance, so that I can delete the background and just have the figure. If I'm doing some black and white line work, I can go in and just delete any bleeps in there that I don't like. I can take an eraser and erase out the lines that I don't want.
So how do you get your illustration into the computer?
I have a scanner.
Okay.
And
so
I've just invested in a huge scanner, major bucks, to accommodate 11 by 17, which is great. It's worth every penny.
Sure, because I imagine a lot of the work you do for publishers has to be larger.
It does, and a lot of the publishers now are expecting you to have to scan everything yourself. They don't want the original art anymore. So I have to scan the work myself and give it to them on disk or send it to an FTP site to them, which can be a lot of work because it does take time to get all the colors right and to sort of clean everything up.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning that you have a drawing pad
mm-hmm.
that hooks into the computer.
Mm-hmm.
How do you integrate your illustration on the computer into that tool? Do you import it?
So I scan it in the scanner and get it. I pop it right up on my screen in Photoshop, mm-hmm. and I work on it in Photoshop.
Okay, so the drawing pad interacts with Photoshop.
It does, yes.
Okay, that's neat. Anything else on the computer that comes to mind?
I took a Photoshop class this last fall, which was really helpful. And so at some point I would like to try doing some drawing or combining. And what I like about Janet Stevens' work is that she does a combination of, she imports some photographs and different work that she's done, and she combines it on the computer,
okay.
in a computer image. And it's really nice because it is a combination of the real painterly style that she works in, but also combined with some computer techniques, which is neat.
Oh, yeah. It's opening up, I'm sure, a whole new aspect of illustrating.
It really is. And some of the educational publishers, that's what they want, is they prefer sometimes the digital work over other work. I think because it translates to different sizes much more easily, and it's a little more flexible in some ways.
Do you have a favorite character of your own invention?
Probably the sheep that I showed you, partly because I've worked on those really hard to try to get to come up with a character that I'm happy with. I also have a character of a basset hound that I've played with a lot, and I love basset hounds,
mm-hmm.
and they're just really fun to draw.
They're really expressive.
Yes.
Big sad
eyes.
Yes. I love that your sheep are knitting.
Uh-huh.
I think that's
uh-huh.
great. And there was one sort of cartoon on your website that showed a couple people who were sort of scratching their bald heads, and
yes,
to them their
yes,
sheep was knitting.
Yes.
That was funny. What was that for? Is that
There is a site online called Illustration Friday, and every week they send us a word that is the word of the week that we illustrate. And I sort of forget what the word was for that, but that was for one of their, and we post it so that you can access it from their site.
And is that meant to be a place that you can find exercises to get you going, or is that just...
Yeah, it is kind of. I think it's kind of a inspiration of the week, so that, you know, sort of to get your brain moving. And
so it's
a lot of people.
It's
not a contest. A lot of people do it, and you can just go in and look at, you know, click on to everyone's blog who's done the picture of the week, and you can leave comments, and they'll leave comments on your site as well.
Now, speaking of blogs, I should mention you have a great website, and it's www.amyhuntington.com. And you have a blog in there.
Yes.
It tends to be more of a pictorial blog.
Yes.
Which is appropriate. What you mentioned Where the Wild Things Are. What was? Do you have other favorite books as a child?
I have a book that I still have. It was probably my all-time favorite, and it was a collection of Andersen fairy tales. And those collections would typically have one color plate illustration for each story. And, you know, that is a well-worn copy of stories.
Mm-hmm. Were you inspired to become an illustrator through books and pictures, or did it happen, you know, later when you were in high school and you had a particularly inspirational art teacher? Or
I did have a very inspirational art teacher, but my dad is also an artist, not professionally, but always as a pastime. And my grandmother was one of the first female greeting card designers in the Boston area.
Uh-huh.
She was born around 1900, and so she would have been working in the 20s, 30s, 40s. So she was definitely an influence as well.
Do you have her work?
I do. I have some of her greeting cards.
Oh, great.
And some of her work that she did in college. And she did some I have some etchings of hers hanging around also.
What was her name?
Dorothy. Dorothy Huntington.
So what are you working on now? You mentioned that you're working on a book.
I'm working on a book about a sheep right now who doesn't want to be shorn. And that's all I'll say about that because I have a... I sort of like to keep that to myself until I've got the whole thing done. But and I'm working on the alphabet cards, which I would also like to publish. And I'm not really sure where I'm going to go with those yet.
When you work as an illustrator for a publisher that has another author, do they come to you with the text first?
Yeah, I basically just get the text on a sheet of paper. And so it's left up to me where I want to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
I break up the text, decide what I'm going to illustrate on each page. And once the sketches are done, once the sketches are done, I'll send those back to the editor or the art director, and they have comments that they'll make. And with the smaller publishers, I find that they also will send them to the author, so the author will give feedback as well. And I give feedback to the author, too, as far as editing, if there are things that I think should be changed a little bit to gel better with the pictures.
Now, you have an art representative.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work come through that person usually, or do the publishers come directly to you?
She represents me for all of the children's illustration that I do.
So what advice generally do you have for people who want to be illustrators?
As far as being children's book illustrators, I think my first bit of advice would be to get a good background in just in fine art in general, a degree in an art school, especially one where it doesn't have to be a noted art school, but just one where you have someone that you can connect to, a professor in the field that you can connect to. And then I think it's just a matter of really doing your research and, checking out what publishers are out there, what they're publishing, what kind of illustration they're looking for, and sort of, at the same time you're working up your own style and what kind of illustration, what kind of niche you fall into as an illustrator. And really just spend a lot of time looking at children's books, and children's illustration.
My last question about writing is there any certain exercise or activity you turn to when you need a little spark of inspiration?
It sort of depends on what I'm doing. I do a lot of educational work, which would be books like readers that specifically schools will buy. And that kind of work has very tight deadlines, and so I really just have to sit down and do it. And my inspiration is just the fact that I'm sitting there doing it. But for other work, I really think most of my inspiration comes from two things. One is looking at other art, whether it's other illustrators or other artists who I admire. Looking through books, looking through magazines, going online. The other thing that I think is also very good is just to get away from it, and I've really liked traveling lately now that my kids are grown, and I think just going out and seeing different places and different people and taking pictures, that is very much an inspiration for my new work.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
And we'll keep our eyes open for your book. Matthew and Tall Rabbit Go Camping by Susan Meyer, which is coming out in April.
Thank you very much.
That was a conversation with Vermont author and illustrator Amy Huntington. Her website is amyhuntington.com. You may have noticed that the audio on that one was a little bit different than it is these days. I didn't used to use a microphone when I first started out, and it definitely makes a difference to use the mic, but that's one of my favorite interviews. Amy is an incredibly generous and interesting person to talk to. She's going to be participating in an upcoming event, which isn't here in Vermont, but just in case anybody might be traveling New England, there's going to be something called the Snow Splash Book Bash, a day of outdoor and indoor activities with snow sports, stories, and crafts. That's going to happen on Tuesday, February 22nd, from 11 to 1 at Pineland Farms Market and Outdoor Center in New Gloucester, Maine. So if any of you are going to be in Maine that day, February 22nd, you should know that that is going to be happening. I would love to hear from anybody who has any comments about Write the Book or news about book-related events. Please always feel free to send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you have a prompt, I'm always happy to hear suggested prompts. I'd be very happy to credit you for your idea. I also want to remind you that The Radiator is community radio, and what that means is that it's all volunteer and it relies on the support and involvement of the community. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Cheryl Willoughby is here, and she's going to be on the air in about 3 minutes for your 3 o'clock hour, 2 hours with the world of music. Listen and enjoy. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.